This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Brothers, the True Crime Podcast.
Right, everyone, I'm here with author Emma Flint. Emma, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, you are an author of two books now. I have one of them in my hand, which is Other Women. Your first one was Little Deaths, which came out 2017?
Yes, that's right.
We're getting way ahead of ourselves, though. Let's talk about your childhood. So, based on a stalkerish review of your website, emmaflint.com, you grew up in Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to find out where your love of literature came from, because you went on to do an MA in English language and literature. You've done a novel writing course after that. We've just had World Book Day, and my little girl at school went dressed up as Rapunzel, which isn't really a book, but there's a book tie-in to the film Tangled. But anyway, so I'm just wondering where your love comes from, and what's your earliest memory of literature, reading, and did they even have World Book Day? I don't remember it when
no,
I was at school.
They definitely didn't have World Book Day. The first memory I've got, I guess, is probably most people are the same, as being read to by my parents, especially my mum. My mum was a primary school teacher, so she taught me to read before I went to school. And I've still got all my old Ladybird books. Some of them have still got muddy fingerprints or bits of porridge that my brother probably flicked at me while I was reading. So probably being read to. The first book that I read on my own, the first sort of grown-up book that I read, was The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And the idea of children, I think, really love having secrets from adults. The idea of having a secret world through a wardrobe that only children knew about was just completely intoxicating.
I don't think that's a book I've read. Is it Lewis Carroll or C.S. Lewis? One of the
two. C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis. Yeah, I know it was Lewis something. I always remember growing up, I don't remember learning to read, so it's pretty cool that you remember that, and a benefit that you got taught before going to school with your mum being a teacher, which is cool. I always used to read them Goosebumps books. Do you remember them?
I do. They came out when I was too old to read them, I think. But yeah, I do remember them, and I've obviously seen them in shops.
It's cool because kids nowadays, especially at the school my daughter's at, they're kind of really pushing the reading now, whereas when I was young, I don't really remember learning to read too young, I guess. Maybe I'm just not remembering it. What's your opinion on how important it is to read? Because even as an adult, some people don't read for pleasure. They might read if they have to, or if it's a biography of a celebrity. How important is it to get kids reading?
I think it's really important to teach kids to read so that they then have the choice about how much they want to read for pleasure. If you don't teach kids to read, I think you're closing off something that can be a huge source of pleasure, inspiration, information. Having said that, I do think there's a lot of crossover now between books and films. And I don't just mean adaptations of books. I mean, in terms of how we tell stories. So the fact that we all watch so many films and so many series on TV, we're used to devices like flashback and fast forwarding on screen. So you start to see those in novels more and more. And I think whether people read or not, we're all interested in storytelling. I think that's how we make sense of the world. Like if you asked me, what did you do at the weekend? I probably wouldn't say, I saw a friend, I went to the supermarket, I went out with my partner. I'd probably say something like, oh, I saw my friend. She's having a really hard time because she's just broken up with this guy who's a complete wanker. And I told her never to get together with him. You know, you make a story out of it. That's how you talk about the world. That's how you make sense of the world, I think.
At what point did you realize that you wanted to actually start writing books then? Because as an adult, you've done your courses and stuff, but it must have come before that, the interest in changing into that. When was that?
I don't remember a time that I didn't write. I definitely was writing stories when I started school, 4 or 5. I wrote my first book when I was 10, still unpublished. If there's anyone out there who wants to buy the rights. My mum had just introduced me to Agatha Christie, and I was slightly obsessed with Agatha Christie, and I wrote this book about a French detective with an enormous mustache living in an English country house in the 30s, which obviously I knew loads about being a 10-year-old from Newcastle. It was quite dark, actually, and I gave the murderer my name, which, looking back, I think, wow, that was a bit dark. But I remember, you know, sitting in my living room and saying to my parents things like, how long does it take a body to start smelling? And how long after someone dies do you hear about the will? I now know that's not exactly normal for a 10-year-old.
Where do you think this interest in true crime comes from? Because we're in the middle of a wave at the minute, which has been going on for probably a decade, if not more. It's always been there since Jack the Ripper back in the 19th century. What do you think drew you to it? Because as a youngster, it's not something typically you would be interested in, unless someone, I guess, showed you something. I can't remember liking it when I was a youngster.
I actually don't remember where the very first interest came from, but I definitely remember subscribing to one of those awful true crime magazines. Obviously, there was no internet when I was little, so probably a good thing. But they used to come through the door and they focused on a different case each month, I think. I don't think they were weekly. And I've still got them all. So they gave an overview. Each one gave an overview. And I think the first one was Jack the Ripper. So I must have seen that in a shop somewhere. And the interest in Jack the Ripper must have come from somewhere. I mean, my mum is a big, she's interested in crime, I would say. Now she reads psychological thrillers, but she's interested in crime. My aunt, her sister, reads a lot of true crime. I think I must have just seen the books lying around and being kind of interested to know what lay behind those covers, you know, black cover with bright red writing, and kind of it went from there. And then I think the interest was, I can't believe there are people out there who do things like this, you know, so obviously so far removed from my experience. So I was reading true crime apart from Agatha Christie, before I read any other crime novels.
Do you think it should be more accessible to young people? I don't know about ages, but it's probably important to learn about there are bad people out there. But then again, you don't want to take someone's innocence and childhood away from them too soon, I suppose. At what point do you think kids should be granted access to such things as true crime, whether it's magazines or books or learning about case history?
That's a big question. I definitely think I read too much too young. I wanted to be a pathologist by the time I was about 12. And that was solely because of the true crime cases that I'd read about and how pathology had been involved and what they'd been able to detect from the discovery of bodies. I mean, I remember reading about I must have been about 12 or 13. I remember reading about the case of John Hague, who dissolved his victims in acid, and how the pathologist had found these gallstones and been able to prove who it was from the gallstones. I'm not sure that's something that a 12-year-old needs to read about. I think definitely children need to know there are bad people out there, and they need to know. When I was a kid, you know, you were always told, don't accept sweets from anyone, don't get in a car with anyone, but never really what happened after that. And if you tell a child not to do something, they're going to be really curious. Well, what happens if I do? Well, I was anyway. What happens if I do get in the van? You know, what happens if I do take the sweets? To be honest, thinking back, there was a case, actually part of a series of cases, although I didn't know it then. There was a little girl whose name I've now forgotten, who was killed in Coldstream, which was in the Scottish Borders, not far from where I lived. I think she was about 11, and I would have been maybe a year or two younger when she was killed. And it was eventually discovered that the murderer was Robert Black, who killed a number of small young girls, very young girls. And I remember being really fascinated by that in a really horrified way, that girls my age could and did just disappear. That was absolutely terrifying to me. And I became slightly obsessed with that case, I think, because that was what happened when you got in the van or ate the sweets or went with a stranger. So I think probably, in honesty, that's where my interest came from. But yeah, aside from knowing that bad people exist, I really don't think kids need to be reading about the details of real murder cases. I don't think it's a massively healthy thing for a kid to be obsessed with. But as for age limits, no idea. Don't have kids myself. So what do you think?
It's an interesting question, because whenever you upload something such as a podcast, you have the option to make it 18 plus.
Right.
As in, it's not suitable for non-adults. And I think that's probably about right. It depends on how graphic the story is, how much detail you go into. I think 18 plus is a fair, if we're playing ballpark figures, 18 is classed as an adult. What's the difference between 18 and 17 and 16? Probably not much, realistically. But again, I think, like you say, telling people I was told the same, don't accept stuff off a stranger, don't speak to strangers, don't get in cars, which is ironic because now we have Uber, which is strangers that you have on your phone and we trust implicitly to take us somewhere. But yeah, it's interesting because true crime and fiction, in a sense, have a bit of crossover, you know, with the level of detail and the graphic side of things, especially if you're reading quite a dark thriller, that can go into brutal detail. The only difference is that's not real. So should a kid be able to read a dark thriller under the age of 18 because it's fiction versus real life? It's quite hard to differentiate between the two, I find, especially when you're younger.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we put age limits on films, obviously, but we don't on books. So I take your point about podcasts and the 18 age limit, but if a kid can walk into a newsagent's, I don't know if kids still go into newsagents, but I could have bought one of those true crime magazines, and obviously did, at the age of 13 or 14. Or you can walk into the fiction department in any bookshop, the non-fiction department in any bookshop, and buy a book about true crime that has photographs in. There's no age limit on those. And it's the same for thrillers. I mean, I've read crime novels and thrillers with more detail, more horrific detail, that's given me nightmares in a way that true crime hasn't. But yeah, we don't have an 18 sticker on those books.
Interesting that, isn't it? I don't think it ever would be brought in. You mentioned about the photos and stuff, and that's something I hadn't thought of. I read a book once and, you know, there's crime scene photos in there and you can see the blood stains on the floor where someone's body was, and then it got removed. I think it was about the Lizzie Borden in America, you know, where she allegedly killed her whole family, and I think she got away with it, didn't she?
She did, yes.
And then she still lived in the town for the rest of her life, so she had a brass neck. Fair play to her. So when you did the language courses and stuff, that's at University of St. Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
When you were going through high school then, was that love for books and writing just increasing? Were you thinking, I can't wait to get to uni? Was it always in your plans of the direction you wanted to go, from wanting to be a pathologist at, say, 12, to learning about writing and how to turn your love for books into a craft?
So I realized when I was about 14, I think, that I wasn't going to be a pathologist because I'd have to do 3 science A levels, which I wasn't good enough to do, but also I'd have to drop English and history, which is what I really loved. So I think from about 13, 14, I knew I was going to, or I wanted to do an English degree, that I was really set on that. And I was still writing, never showed what I was writing to anybody, never told anybody I was writing, didn't think I was good enough. Went to uni, did an English degree and loved it. And I think it gave me a really good grounding for writing, especially writing historical fiction, because I kind of know where to go, which books to go to get period details if I'm writing about a certain period. But I didn't actually start, I mean, I wrote all the time, but I didn't actually start taking my writing seriously, didn't really show it to anyone until I was in my mid-30s. I think partly that was confidence. Now, I think if I'd had access to the internet younger, I might have been posting stuff on forums and getting feedback and joining writing groups, but it was really hard to make those connections when I was in my 20s. So yeah, I just carried on writing at home, and I thought, well, other people become writers.
You know, when you say it was grounding doing this course, do you mean from a feedback perspective, as in you were getting construct, or you meant it sort of helped you figure out what sort of stuff you like to write about?
Yeah, I think what sort of stuff I like to write about, what sort of stuff I like to read, taught me things about how to create rounded characters, three-dimensional characters, taught me about pace, what makes you keep reading, what makes a book pacey and interesting, taught me about things I didn't like. It also taught me, if you're at university or college and you're having to write an essay, I think I had to write 3 essays every fortnight, roughly. Teaches you about deadlines and writing to deadline and staying on target for a specific topic if you're given a title, essay title. So I'm really glad I did it. But yeah, my writing was much more of a secret for a long time.
I'm curious just about the uni thing, because I've been to uni but not doing English. I'm just curious as to, so you've got the lecturer. Is it one lecturer for the whole 3 years, or is it?
Well, actually, I was there for 4 years in Scotland. It's a 4-year course.
Right, okay.
It's a different lecturer for each topic. So in Scotland, you do 3 subjects in your first year, 3 in your second year, and then you specialise in your final 2 years. I probably had about 9 lectures a week, maybe, for 4 years, I would say, and then tutorials on top of that and essays. So I was exposed to a lot of information and a lot of opinions, lots of different books. Honestly, for someone who loves reading, I used to sit in the library. I know this sounds very nerdy, but I used to sit in the library at my university on the top floor. St. Andrews is right on the coast in Scotland. It's beautiful. I used to look out over the sea, look at the pile of books on my desk and think, I cannot believe that I'm like allowed to be here. You know, this is like my job for 4 years. And it was just, that's my happy place.
That's good that you did something that you love. A lot of people go to uni because they don't know what to do, passes a bit of time, gets a bit of debt. I know in Scotland it's free, right, uni?
I think it's different back then because we still had grants. I'm that old. But I think now it's free if you're Scottish and you go to uni in Scotland.
Which is really good. I'm just curious about the different opinions, because writing, although it's, I don't want to say it's formulaic, because you have to have certain things. You have to have beginning, middle, and end, an arc. You meet a crossroads. You have to make decisions. People change, rounded characters. That's universal. But people have different writing styles, and each genre has, I guess, a different approach. So I'm just curious as to how the different lecturers you had for each subject gave you feedback, because you might get one who thinks that's really good and give you certain tips, but the other lecturer might say that if you utilize those tips, they might not like it because it's subjective. I'm just curious as to how that worked with so many different eyes looking on your work.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that when I was at uni and writing essays, it wasn't fiction. It was responses to other people's work. So you might get an essay on George Eliot. So you'd go out and read 2 or 3 novels by George Eliot, and then you'd write an essay about George Eliot. So it was kind of a response to George Eliot rather than fiction. So I think probably my fiction writing style didn't really take off. It took off while I was at university, but I didn't really show it to anyone. So apart from the stuff that I was reading for my course, I spent a year only reading Hemingway. That was all I read for fun. And I don't know if you've ever read any Hemingway, but it's very, he writes in a very clean, yeah, I guess clean is the best way to describe it. So he doesn't use flowery adjectives. He doesn't use lots of adverbs. He just writes in a very clean, simple way, using very basic language to convey, in some cases, really enormous emotions. He's got a very famous short story, which I think is called Hills Like White Elephants. because there are some hills in the background that look like white elephants. And it's mostly dialogue, conversation between a man and a woman who are getting a train somewhere. And as the story unfolds, you realise that she's about to have an abortion and she doesn't really want one. And he never uses the words abortion, pregnancy or baby at all. And it's, you can feel this tension and you can feel the unhappiness. It's just an extraordinary piece of writing. I mean, as a person, Hemingway was not someone you want to live with, get involved with, nothing like that. As a writer, I think he changed the way that people write, approach fiction, look at fiction.
As someone who's never read Hemingway, I like what you're saying in that it's clean, because I find sometimes authors do use too many adjectives. And sometimes if you're on your Kindle, I spend most of the time in the dictionary highlighting the word and figure maybe I'm just not as well versed in the English language. But what if I was to read Hemingway, what would the, if you had to pick, what would the first book of his be if you were to recommend? This is where you start with Hemingway.
You could start with The Old Man and the Sea, which he won the Nobel Prize for. Personally, I'd start with his short stories. I think they're phenomenal. And I suppose that's where I started. He wrote a great short story. I think it's just called The Killers. And it's about two men who come into a diner and ask for, I think it's a long time since I've read it. I think they ask for the cook and he's not there. And they say they're going to come back. And someone sends a message to the cook, or he sees them. Somehow he knows that they're there and they're coming back. And he lies on his bed and he knows that he's going to be killed. It's a phenomenal story. I don't think you, in fact, I'm sure you don't see the murder, you don't see any bloodshed, anything like that. It's mostly internal. Yeah, I think it's called The Killers, and I have a feeling it was made into a film at some point. So I'd start with his short stories.
It's an interesting technique, that, because what you often find with books, or what I've found, is sometimes there isn't much left to the imagination. So they go into all the detail, which some people would argue is great. That's why some people prefer the books to the films. But I think leaving that open to interpretation, and it's what I'm not saying that's important, is quite an interesting literary technique. You mentioned about he's a bit of a character you wouldn't want to live with. It seems like a fair few authors are a bit rogue. Is that a bit of a common trait with authors, that they're, maybe it's men authors, I don't know, but they're a bit unlivable?
Yeah, probably. You know, you read about someone like Hemingway, who was quite prolific. He wrote a lot, published a lot. As I say, I think he changed the way that people look at fiction. He won the Nobel Prize. He was kind of a giant of literature. He had, I don't know how many children, lots of wives. And as I got older, I sort of looked at his life and then looked at what he achieved. And I thought, yeah, you did no childcare, did you? It's not like you were able to do this despite having to bring up four children, despite having to cook three meals a day. None of this was on you. You were just allowed to go into your study and get on with it, basically. And the number of wives, I guess he was quite a... When someone's that intelligent and that successful, he was a good-looking man. Women were attracted to him, and he was not a faithful man. Maybe it is men. I don't know. I don't know any women authors who are like that. I don't think this is true so much now, I have to say.
Yeah.
All the authors I met are fairly, I was going to say normal. They're not normal. They're very nice people who do their fair share of childcare.
So I think Roald Dahl was similar. He had a little shack, yes, that he locked himself away in and told the kids to do one and the grandkids or whatever when he was writing his book.
Yeah. And I think it was Kingsley Amis, who was married to a novelist. She used to have to interrupt her writing to drive him around when he wanted to go into town, because he couldn't drive. God. We didn't want to drive. So, yeah, she had to interrupt her own work to look after him.
Jesus.
The story will continue after these quick messages.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And now, back to the story.
So your first book, Little Desk, comes out in 2017, like I said. And you mentioned there was a period, maybe a decade or so, where you still kept your writing to yourself. At what point did that change then? Where did this sudden, maybe it wasn't an epiphany, but you all of a sudden got the confidence to share your work. Can you remember a turning point at some point where you thought, right, the world needs to see this?
So I was actually, I tweeted something yesterday about the power of stubbornness. So I remember when I was about, probably about 33, I think, maybe 34. And I'd been seeing this guy for several months and we broke up and we'd had plans for the weekend. And I was sort of like, oh. I mean, it was a mutual breakup, but I was, I think, more annoyed that I had this empty weekend stretching in front of me. And I remember saying to him, what am I supposed to do now this weekend? You know, everybody's busy. It's too late to make new plans. And he said, why don't you do some writing? And I said, what? And he said, well, you're always talking about how you want to write. Now you've got 2 days. Why don't you go and write? And he said it in a way that implied that I wasn't going to write. And I thought, right, I'll show you. So I sat down, started to write. I think bloody mindedness will get you a long way. I started to write. I think that weekend I went to lots of stuff that I'd written, notebooks, stuff that I hadn't typed up, started really looking at what I'd done. And I thought, he's right in a way. If I don't start taking this seriously, nobody else is going to take it seriously. There's no publisher going to knock on the door and say, I hear you're a writer. Let me have a look through your laptop. I thought, if I don't do something about this, I could die and it would never see the light of day. So while I was still in this very bloody-minded frame of mind, I booked a writing course, weekend course, I think maybe in a month or two's time. And when the time came for the course, I was so nervous, I almost didn't go. I remember sitting on the sofa thinking, okay, I don't have to go. Maybe I should just not go. Like, who would know if I didn't go? And in the end, I went on the course, and that changed my life. It was the first time I'd read anything out loud to people. I met this writing tutor who taught at Birkbeck University in London. She was the tutor on the course. And at the end of it, the end of the course, I'd had an amazing time. I'd got great feedback. She said to me at the end of the 2 days, what are you going to do now? And I said, oh, well, I'm going to go home and I've got to go back to work tomorrow, but I've had a really good time. And she went, no, what are you going to do with your writing? She said, you're obviously a writer, so what are you going to do? And I thought, wow, okay, that's the first time someone's ever called me a writer. So I went home, I booked myself on another course, I joined a writing group in London, and I started to take it more seriously. And I think what made the difference for me was taking myself seriously and not thinking about it as, I was going to say, not just a hobby. I mean, it was a hobby, like I wasn't earning, obviously wasn't earning anything from it, but I thought, I need to put the work in. If I'm going to get anywhere with this, I need to stop treating it as optional. And I need to kind of knuckle down and do it regularly and put myself out there and take risks and join a writing group and say, okay, I'm going to bring some work along in 2 weeks and give myself a bit of accountability. That's what made the difference.
It's important, isn't it, to see yourself as that. So it's okay, say I've done an English lit course and language and I can write. I've not shared it with anyone. I sort of do it when I want every other night, not taking it too serious. But when third parties are referring to you as a writer and you think, yeah, I am a writer. But now I'm calling myself a writer. I have to act like a writer.
Exactly.
And write.
Yeah. Yeah. Writers don't swan around with I am a writer on a t-shirt. There's only one thing you have to do to be a writer, which is actually write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard a quote from a friend of mine who's getting his debut novel published this summer. And I don't think it's his quote, but he said, you can't edit a blank page, which I think is so powerful. So when you're writing, it sounds like, and there's something called free writing, which I think is different to get you more into the flow of just typing on a page, I guess, but just write something. It's quite common to want to edit as you go along from a novice's perspective. But what he's suggesting is you write something down, then kind of maybe forget about it for a day, then come back to it and edit it. I mean, what's your experience with stuff like writer's block, or does free writing work for you? What's your process when you want to start writing something, I guess, is my question.
I do lots and lots and lots of free writing. And if I've got my characters in my head, if I'm in the middle of something and I don't know where to go, I just start free writing. And it usually ends up being about the characters, because that's what I'm thinking about. I actually write by hand.
Really?
I write all my first drafts by hand, everything. So I write by hand, and then maybe at the end of a week, I'll type up what I've written that week. So that's the first edit, as I type up. But writing by hand, that's how I do all the free writing. I find it really hard to be creative while I'm typing. And also, it sort of stops you editing as you go, because you're writing by hand, and because my handwriting's quite big. There's not, even if you read it through, when you finished, you go back and you read that paragraph through again. It's hard to edit on a notebook page because you just don't have the space. I love writing by hand. People say to me, oh, you've got lovely handwriting. I never write anything by hand. And I think, why? When did we stop? You're still allowed to write by hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Just for the benefit of my audience, anyone that doesn't know, could you just explain free writing in simplistic terms?
Yeah. So a friend introduced me to the idea, I suppose. She said, you sit down and you just write. And the only rule, you can write about anything you like, in any way that you like. You can write poetry, dialogue, prose. The only rule is that you're not allowed to take your pen off the page. So some days I'm literally writing, I don't know what to write next. I feel really stupid. I desperately need some coffee. Just keep writing, and eventually you'll get through all the, I feel stupid, I need some coffee, and you'll get to the actual writing. It was a website that I found with tips, and it said you should make a note. So you can only do free writing for so long, because you can only access that part of your brain for so long. And eventually other things start creeping back in, like my supermarket delivery's due, or I need to go and do some work, or I've got to let the cat out, practical things. But you should set a different timer. So try it for 15 minutes, see what you produce. And try it for 30 minutes and see what you produce. But also set two timers. So try it for 30 minutes, but set a timer for 25 minutes and see what you produce in the last 5 minutes. And I've realized what I produce in the last 5 or 10 minutes, that's the really valuable stuff. That's the best stuff. For me, it's not the stuff at the beginning. Stuff at the beginning is rubbish. It takes me a little while to write into what I want to get to.
It's just like warming up, isn't it? I suppose.
Yes.
If you're gonna exercise and run a marathon, you're not just gonna get out there and run.
It's just like exercise. You have to do it regularly. Can you imagine just walking out the front door and trying to run 5 miles if you haven't run for months?
Definitely
it's
not.
It's just like exercise. You have to do it regularly. You have to stay fit, as in you have to stay in the habit of doing it. I don't run. I wish I could. I don't. I have run. But when you get towards the end of your run and it's downhill all the way home and you know you've only got 7 minutes and then you can get in the shower, that's when you feel really good. Sometimes that's what free writing's like.
I think there's a book Stephen King wrote called Stephen King on Writing, which is quite famous from, I don't know, the year 2000 or something, a few years ago now. And he implies in there, from what I've heard, I've not read it admittedly, that it's important to read as many books as possible in as many different genres as possible, just to try and soak up writing styles, information, how to build characters, universes. Once you figure out what you like to write about, so for yourself, you've got Little Deaths and Other Women, both of which are fiction, but it's almost like a fictional retelling of a real story. So that's kind of your niche, I guess, if you want to call it that. Once you've figured out what you like to write about, do you still think it's important to read books in other genres to soak up that information rather than just focusing on that? Because you could limit yourself, I suppose, if you did that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know what I want to write, but how I write it can vary. I have a writing voice and a writing style, but I think Little Deaths and Other Women are, like, you would know they were written by the same person, but they're not exactly the same style, because my style has changed over the time that I've written it. I also think can be interesting to see how other writers and other styles can influence your own writing. It can be really interesting to read something that you hate and try and work out why you hate it. I actually really struggling to think of a specific author that I hate, but I suppose I don't like cliche. That's what would stop me finishing a book, would be cliche. So cliched metaphor, cliched characters, you know, the cop who's about to turn in his badge and gets involved in one last case, and, you know, something awful, either awful or brilliant's going to happen to him. That kind of cliche really puts me off. I want stuff that's original. And I've learned that by reading stuff I don't like.
I mean, for your books, it's strong female characters. That's kind of common in both books there. And this book, Other Women, so the paperback version, March 7th, it came out.
Yes.
Last week. Hardback came out last year. And it's kind of written from the perspective of two women. So you've got B and you've... It's right, and I'm saying B for Beatrice.
Yes, yeah,
B and Kate, and the third party in this is Tom. And it comes just after the Great War, about 5 years removed. And, I mean, it does say on the back, B does get killed. So it's not a spoiler because it's on the blurb. And we're trying to figure out how she died, who killed her, and it's all in the build-up to that. I'm not there yet, so I don't know what happens. I'm excited to find out. One of my Facebook group members actually bought your book recently. I'm going to give her a shout out because I put on that I was going to speak to her. This was last week. I hadn't seen that that you were suffering a little bit, so we rearranged it. But Jill Sharp on my Facebook group, she was going to buy some insurance and stuff, you know, some important things for the house. And I said, you should buy the book. So she did.
Instead of the insurance. Oh, my God.
I like to think that the insurance probably came as well.
I hope so.
But yeah, I'm just interested in the style from different people's perspectives because you've always got a bit of flashback and sort of, I don't want to call it time travel, but you've got before the main event and after. So I'm just interested into how you came to writing it in that particular style, really.
So this case interested me because of the characters involved. I think all novels, well, most novels, probably start with a question. My question, I came to this case, like I started writing this book when I was 42. Beatrice Cade is based on a real person who was in her late 30s at the time that my novel starts. So she was not far off my age. It's set in the 1920s. It's almost exactly 100 years ago. In fact, it's 99 years ago and 11 months today that they went off together. She was an intelligent, independent woman with a career. She had friends, she had hobbies, she had things she was passionate about. She was the kind of woman that you might meet today and get on with. And I couldn't understand why a woman who had all of that going in her life risked so much to have an affair with a man who she knew was married, and not just married, but I think she knew right from the beginning that he wouldn't leave his wife. She was having an affair with a guy that she met at work. Back then, if that had come out, she would have lost her job, and I don't think he would. She potentially, if the affair had come out, some of her friends would have rejected her. By sleeping with him, she was risking pregnancy. This was at a time before the NHS, before the welfare state. She was risking destitution, poverty. There were no legal abortions. If she'd gone down the abortion route, she was risking death. There was a huge amount of risk in that relationship. And my question was, why would a woman like that risk so much? So that's why I originally started looking at the case. And when I started writing about it, I realized that there's not an awful lot of mystery about who killed her. That's why it's not a spoiler to say that she's killed, because there's only really one suspect. So from the perspective of the reader who knows about the affair, there isn't anyone else who could have done it. But at the time, there was no tangible link between the man she has the affair with, who I call Tom in the book. There was no link between him and her. He'd been very careful to keep the affair secret. He'd rented this cottage for them in the middle of nowhere, and he'd used a false name. So there was no proof that he'd even been at the cottage. Back in those days, you didn't have any ID, so he'd just paid for it, and that was it. So for me, the mystery was about whether or not he would get away with the murder. Firstly, why he'd killed her, and then would he get away with it? That's what I thought the tension was about. So the reason that I wrote it like that was I had to have Bee's voice to explain the reason that they got involved and how the relationship built up and how it ended in murder. And I had to have another voice to explain what happened during the trial and to explain why there was a strong possibility that he might get away with murder. Originally, I tried to write the whole thing in Bee's voice and obviously realised she dies halfway through, so that wasn't going to work. And then I tried out other voices to try and tell the rest of the story and couldn't find the right one. And then I went to bed one night and I had a dream about the wife. She tried to phone me in the dream and I woke up and I thought, okay, she's obviously got things she wants to say. So she became my other narrator. In real life, there's absolutely nothing out there that I could find about the wife. There's a tiny photograph in one of the newspapers, really bad photo. I went to the archives, I looked in the files about the case, police record about the case, and all I found was one statement which had clearly been written by a police officer, not by her, because it says things like, my husband proceeded into the living room and my husband telephoned me at 7:41 a.m. I mean, that's not natural, that's not how people speak, so I knew it wasn't written verbatim. So yeah, I had to create her from scratch. I wanted to create this tension between, there are obviously two women, both in a relationship with this one man. Initially, there's a lot of animosity between them because they're in competition for him. And then it turns out that Kate holds a key piece of evidence that could end the trial and decide whether he's found guilty or innocent.
That's interesting about the wife thing there, that she was sort of brought in after a dream while you spoke to her, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Weird. That doesn't happen.
Talk to me about the title, because I think it's very interesting. So Other Women, this is sort of about the historical aspect of this. So you've mentioned the type of woman that Bee is. People like her at the time in the 20s were classed as these other women. So just explain how you came to that title and how important it is to portray her as one of these other women.
So obviously Bee is Kate's, Tom's wife. To Kate, Bee is the other woman in the relationship. To Bee, Kate is the other woman. Even though she's married to him, she's still the other woman in this triangle. So there was obviously that aspect of it. But yes, you're right. I think the first page of the novel kind of talks about three types of women. So there's the young, unmarried women, women who've never been married, women who are kind of young and flirtatious, and they get a lot of male attention. There's the second type of women who are either married or widowed. They've got wedding rings. They get called madam in shops and by men because they're clearly married or have been married. And then there was this third type of woman who became a lot more prevalent after the First World War, which is middle-aged women who had never been married. So I think I call them misses without youth. I think that's what I call them, because they're still miss, but they're obviously not like these young unmarried girls. And the reason for that was there were obviously hundreds of thousands of men who went away to Europe in the First World War and either didn't come back or came back damaged in some way, whether that was physically harmed or they came back with mental health issues like PTSD. They came back not wanting to have relationships or unable to form relationships. So there was a whole generation of women who were often called surplus women, extra women, other women, who had been brought up to think they would lead a life exactly like their mothers. They'd been brought up and taught how to be a wife, how to run a house, how to be a mother. And all of a sudden, the possibilities of being a wife and being a mother were closed to them because the men weren't there. Some of these women had got jobs during the First World War, but when men came back, they expected to just walk back into their jobs. So these women often didn't. They didn't even have the option of a career, some of them. And I thought this was a really interesting concept that I hadn't really seen explored that much in a novel set in that period. And I thought it was important to me that Beatrice, who is one of these other women, she fundamentally believes that she'll never be a wife or a lover or a mother because those avenues have closed off to her. But I decided that I wasn't going to make her a victim. She's not someone who feels sorry for herself. She was going to find a job. She was going to make a life for herself. She was going to carve out a new type of life, completely different to what she thought she'd be. She's going to make the best of the situation. And I think up until the time that she met Tom, she did have this happy, rich, multi-layered life. She had a lot going on in her life. She was financially independent. She had a career. I wanted to create in the reader a real sense, not of, oh, poor her, she didn't have much going on in her life. But when she's killed, I wanted the reader to feel a real sense of loss. I think sometimes you don't feel that in crime novels and when you watch something on TV or in a film. Sometimes when the focus is on the killer, you don't feel a sense of loss that a life has gone, that a life's been taken. And I really wanted the reader to feel this is a tragedy. This shouldn't have happened.
The final thing I'd like to ask you about, Emma, is how you found it writing in a period 100 years ago, because it's quite, I suppose, hard to connect with such a drastically removed culture in the time of the aftermath of the Great War. So you'll have done a lot of history research. You're into history, which is makes it enjoyable, I guess. Did you face any challenges setting this novel in such a time period so far removed from what we're used to now?
Yes and no. So, as you say, I did a lot of research into the period. There were things that were relatively easy to find out. So what did women wear? I had the basic facts of the case. So I knew, for example, that Beatrice had lived in this, what we would now call like a very upmarket hostel. So it was called a ladies' club, and it was a house effectively in central London that was for single women, almost like a boarding house. Everybody had their own room, they shared bathrooms, and I had a lot of fun writing about the characters who might have lived there. That was a real place. So I knew, for example, from the research, I knew where she'd lived and what that place was like. There were things that I found it's like little details that I find it quite difficult to work out. I remember sitting for a couple of hours and thinking, what did people do for lunch when they worked in an office, 1923? Did you take sandwiches? Did you go out every day? It must have been too expensive to eat in a cafe every day. And in the end, I thought, do you know what? I just need to put in what's relevant to the story, which is that Tom takes B out for lunch and kind of semi-seduces her over terrible lunches in terrible restaurants. But the things that I think are important in the novel are the feelings and the emotions of the characters. So a woman developing a crush on a guy that she works with, that is not any different in 1924 to 2024. A woman feeling jealousy or anger or frustration or guilt, all of those feelings, they haven't changed at all. So you can write about those feelings in the same way that you would write about them now. And people sometimes say to me, how do you create a sense of period? And yes, you do need to do some research and you do need to include those details, but people are people. I quite often, like I might go into a gallery and look at portraits of the period and look at the people in them and think, you know, I got up this morning and I had a headache, so I had to have an extra cup of coffee. And then it was annoying because the heel broke on my shoe on the way to the station. Those things happened 100 years ago. They happened 200 years ago. People still got annoyed by their kids. They still had insomnia. They still got indigestion. It's all of those things. They're universal.
Cool. Well, I'm going to put a link for Other Women in this episode's description. Thank you for coming on and talking about it. Let's end with one critical piece of advice. If you were to give someone said, Emma, I want to write my first book. I'm putting you on the spot here with this. What's one piece of advice that maybe you wish you would have known at the start that you would pass on to the next upcoming author?
Gosh, I've got loads. The most important thing I think I wish I'd known, which would have made me start writing sooner, is to find a writing group. And if you can't find one, set one up. That will give you feedback, so you can take your work to them. They'll read it, they'll give you feedback on whether it works or not. And it will give you accountability. So if you say, right, I'm going to send you my novel next week, I'm going to send it by the 19th of March, that gives you deadlines. Because otherwise you can sit, as I did, on your own, and write on your own for years and years and never do anything with it. If you have a writing group and they really believe that what you're writing is good, they will encourage you. And if it's not good, they'll help you get into shape and make it good.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for your time, Emma. Other Women is out now. Please go and buy it and read it. I am thoroughly enjoying it. And I'll see everyone listening next time.